Good morning. I'm Anna Maria Tremonti, and you're listening to The Current. Coming up, what do you have to do to be considered a successful environmentalist? Tsipora Berman is credited with helping to save nearly 5 million hectares of BC forest, a game changer in the environmental movement. I'll speak with her shortly. But first, Canadian society was pretty clear on what made up a family 50 years ago, and if the family didn't quite meet the standard, sacrifices were made. To be young, single, and pregnant can be a terribly stressful time for a woman. These days, most Canadian women have options. 50 years ago, women were also told they had options, but abortion was a criminal offense, and social workers, doctors, and the government all believed they knew what was best. And it wasn't for the mother and child to try to make it as a family. Our producer, Kathleen Goldhar, heard from a number of mothers who say they were forced to give up their newborns. For years, these women thought they were alone, but they have slowly opened up about their experiences. They want answers. They're even asking the federal government for an inquiry into the practices of their social workers and doctors. This is one of their stories.
Okay, my name is Sharon Peterson, and this is my story. The beginning
is a love story.
Well, I met this gorgeous guy that I was totally besotted with. He was beautiful. I was 19. I was working. Oh, I think in 1964 we were much more naive than 19-year-olds are today. I had had sex before once, but I thought it was kind of boring. but I was a good Catholic girl. He was a good Catholic boy. He was about four and a half, maybe 5 years older than me. Had a beautiful voice, very handsome. I knew that if you missed your period, you were pregnant. I didn't know how you got pregnant. I thought you decided to get pregnant. I had two childless aunts, and I asked them why they didn't have children, because I had another aunt who had four. And they said, well, we decided not to have children, not to get pregnant. I thought, well, that's easy. You just decide. That's how naive I was.
When Sharon told her family the news,
all hell broke loose. And I had decided that I was just going to go away and have this baby and I'd figure it out later. But I was, right from the get-go, I was keeping the baby. I wasn't going to give it up. Christmas Day. Christmas dinner was ready. My stepfather was a vicious, violent alcoholic. So he'd been drinking all day, and my mother called everyone. The turkey was ready, I guess, for us to come. And we were going to open our gifts after dinner. My parents both worked. So my father, stepfather, took all the gifts under the tree that were for me, and he opened the back door. This is interior BC. It's very, very cold out. And he took all my gifts to the garbage can. He threw them all in because I was garbage. And I thought, you idiot. I knew he was drunk. And then he threw me out into the snow. There's no bloody way I was going to sit at his Christmas table. So he literally threw me out of the house. I didn't have a coat. I didn't have anything on my feet. And I was to go and not come back. So I walked around the front of the house, and somebody, I don't know who, my brother or my mother, somebody threw my coat out, and there was about 4 or 5 feet of snow, and I walked and I walked and I walked, and I had no idea where I was going. And all the houses, everybody, the Christmas tree lights were on, and everybody was sitting down. Completely clear night, starry night. And my mother came looking for me in the car. I had no idea where I was going. I think I was even sitting in a snowbank. I can't remember. Oh, So the next day, Boxing Day, at 10 o'clock in the morning, was my uncle, my favorite uncle. So he came in, and he shook his fist in my face, and he said, "You get out of this town as soon as you can, and don't you ever darken my door." And then an aunt came the next day, and she cried, because how were her boys going to live in this town, considering I had done this? How was she ever going to sing in the choir? And why had I done this to her and her boys? So it was arranged that I would bus down to Vancouver on New Year's Eve. So New Year's Eve day, my mother worked up at the hospital, and she had to be there at 7 o'clock in the morning. And so she was going to drive me to the bus stop. So we get downtown to the bus depot, and she pulled in, didn't even turn the motor off. I'd hardly gotten out of the car, and she threw my suitcase into the snowbank and got back in and drove off. Nothing else, just that was it. And it was the red eye run down to Vancouver. And I was to get a cab from the bus stop there to an aunt and uncle who lived there.
Sharon is sent to Victoria. There, she splits her time between her godmother's house and the home of an aunt.
So I'm starting to show by now and feel life and so on. And then I went to my my godmother, actually. So as soon as I get there, I get the third degree from her of what I'm going to do. I'm going to do all the cleaning and the cooking and the babysitting. She had four boys, and I was not to leave the house under any circumstances. If I wanted to, I would have to ask her, but I wouldn't be going anywhere. So I stayed there at this place and did the cooking and the cleaning and the babysitting. And then on the weekends, I would go to this other aunt. And I did the cleaning there on Saturday. And then Sunday night, they took me back to this other place. Somehow I was going to get away from these people. You see, that's what kept me going. I didn't know how I was going to do it, but somehow I had to have this baby and we were going to be okay. I stayed in my room. I pretty much didn't have anything to do with these adults in my life. They had ugly things to say to me, so I just stayed away. I thought, I had nothing to say to you people. I only have to figure out how to get away from you.
Sharon has regular visits with the social worker.
It says right in my notes, in the her notes, that a worse effect, that I wasn't cooperative and I wasn't taking advantage of the, was it counseling, or the advice that's being offered to other mothers in this same predicament. Well, no, I wasn't. I mean, anytime she started talking about adoption, I said, you can stop right there because it's not going to happen. And even sometimes she would terminate the appointment. She says, you're just being silly. I'd like you to leave the office. God, I used to be so mad when I'd come out of there. I was home alone, and I felt the first pangs of labor. And I had asked, how is this going to go? Oh, they'll tell you at the hospital. It was so awful. I went into labor. I started labor about 1 o'clock in the afternoon. So around 7 o'clock, I think I was about, I don't know how far, but maybe 10 or 15 minutes apart or something like that. We drive over to the Royal Jubilee Hospital, and my aunt just doesn't turn off the motor or anything. Well, this is it. And I said, well, are you coming in? And I said, oh, no, you just walk in. They'll see you. They'll know what to do. I walked up these few steps, and honestly, it blanked out. I don't know. Anyway, next thing I know, I'm in a room, a labor room, I guess. And I'm thinking something has really gone wrong here because this is hurting. I don't know, but this isn't good. No painkillers, nothing, nothing. And I was screaming and carrying on. Nurse came in and she said, be quiet. There's mothers here trying to sleep. I was so scared. So I decided I would die. Because that can happen in childbirth. And I thought, well, that's what I'll do. There's nothing here. I'll just die. And it looks like you know, they'll find the place for the baby, because they'd been talking about this adoptive couple that they'd picked out, and I had made up my mind I would die. I think I got a shot then, and I was drugged. I was drugged for 3 days. My left hand was tied to the bed rail, and my breasts were bound tight, 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 tight. It was just really humiliating, the whole hospital experience. Wouldn't let me see my baby. I can't talk for a minute. Even when I asked, what did I have? What do you care? When I asked to see my baby, the doctor didn't come to see. He stayed in the hospital 7 to 10 days, then I think it was 7 days. It was finally, the doctor came in, I asked him if I could see the baby. Oh, I don't think that would be a good idea. I said, I'd like to see my baby. So either later that day or maybe the next day, I can't remember, nurse came in and she said, well, doctor said you can see your baby. Can't hold her. You can't go in the nursery, but you can see her through the window. So they took me down. They showed me a baby. And I thought, I don't think so, but anyway, there's a baby. So I wanted to go again. And they showed me, I think a baby had hardly any hair at all. And then the next time, had a lot of hair, straight hair. And then the third time, it was reddish hair. And then the fourth time, it was curly, curly dark hair, and that was my baby. I knew that was her. So they weren't even showing me the right baby. They were just showing me a baby.
Sharon leaves the hospital alone. She moves to the YWCA.
July 24th. It was the most horrible day of my life. That's the point. I can't get past that. That just consumed me, that whole episode. I was at the Y, it was a day like today, not a cloud in the sky, and I was sure that that was the day I was going to have my baby was going to be there, right? I mean, nobody told me how this was going to happen, but I figured, all right, now you think you're going to get the baby? No, you're not. I'm going to get the baby. And I didn't know how this was going to work, but today's the day. I'm not signing any papers. I'm getting my baby today.
This is a few weeks after the baby is born. And Sharon goes to her last meeting at her social worker's office.
I cried, of course. I cried. I begged. I screamed. I kicked. I threw furniture. Other social workers came into this room. She called for X to help. I said, and I was literally throwing furniture around and pushing paper. Probably wrote it up like she was, if they could say I was unfit before. They certainly had something to say now about it. They threatened to call the police. They put the pen in my hand and tried to make me sign it, and I threw the pen away. I swore. I did everything. My dad would swear if he wanted, so I swore. I never swore before, but I thought maybe that works. And this fighting went on for quite a bit. And screaming, and I called them names, and I just, everything, I tried so hard, and then they threatened to call the police. And I thought, why are you calling the police? I just want my baby. And so I signed. And then they'd had enough of me. They got the signature and we went out. They actually pushed me out this door, and there was this long sidewalk that goes to the street. And I was just empty. I walked away and I turned back, and there was one of them standing with her arms folded at the door to make sure I didn't come back in. She's shaking her finger at me. So I walked down the sidewalk, and there was this huge tree. And I was so despondent. My head was down, I walked right into the street, bang, just like that. And I turned around, and I walked from there all the way to Dallas Road to the beach. And I sat there all day. I can't tell you what I did, if I cried, or what I did. It's blank. I had to be back at the Y by 11 because they closed the doors. You couldn't get in. And I wanted to tell somebody. But of course I can't, because this is when the secret starts.
Sharon's struggle to find peace is only just beginning. And she is just one of hundreds of young women who were forced to give up their babies. Joyce Masalink is a social worker who started working in the 1960s.
The interesting thing in social work, people came out of the protection model, you know, which was protecting children that were neglected. And there was sort of an assumption generally that young women didn't have the wherewithal or the economics to take care of their children. However, there were a number of us who felt very strongly about that all choices needed to be offered. There was no thought that the system should support them in becoming parents or whatever, because societal values, you know, dictated what was the right thing to do. You needed a two-parent family and, you know, the money to raise them. Certainly a girl would feel like she is forced, especially when she has no support by the community or by the system. The impact of loss on all three parties is huge. It's a lifetime loss. And the feeling of having empty arms is just horrible. And if that's not acknowledged, you can't deal with it.
At 67, I'm looking back on my life and thinking, I survived. All I did was survive. It was one mountain after another, with relationships and jobs, and it makes me kind of mad. By the time the papers were signed, I lost, something died, a sense of what I thought I was as a person. Not developed in 19, but I still had a sense of who I was somehow. It's gone. It just... And I never, sometimes I almost get there and then it just kind of, something died. Something, part of me was taken that I don't know if I'll ever get back. Preparing for this interview, I'm thinking, yeah, I know who she is. I can look back and I can see me at 19. Like, I remember, yeah, I know who you are. I remember what I was like, how I saw the world. But it's a long time ago. And I don't know how you ever make up for not being able to open up, blossom. I have two other children. I was a good mom in a lot of ways, but I didn't quite believe that I was. I think my kids feel it. I think they feel that I wasn't as present to them as I could have been. It was always sort of clouded. I always wondered where the other one was. You never forget, always looking.
In 2008, more than 40 years later, Sharon reconnects with her daughter with the help of a friend who finds her online.
January the 14th, I believe, was the first time we spoke. And now she's in my life. I know what she looks like. I know where she lives. So the searching is over. And she's lovely. She's had her times, but I mean, she's got a lovely husband, lovely children, lovely home. And so that was a relief, because I didn't know if she was okay. And there were times I wanted so much to know how she was doing. Was she okay? It's a little strange. It's not hard. I'm glad she's in my life, but I'll never have my baby. You know, there's just so much missed. You have to think of it as a motor vehicle accident and you've lost your leg. But that's okay. You've got a prosthesis and you can get around. But you will never walk the same way again. You won't even dance the same way again. You won't even get out of bed the same way again. And it's a pain. You'll never forget it. And every time you look at your leg gone, that's what it's like. And you just have to live your life.
We have been listening to the documentary Motherhood Interrupted, produced by The Current's Kathleen Goldhar. We welcome your thoughts about what you hear on The Current. To contact us, go to our website, cbc.ca/thecurrent, and click on the Contact Us link, or call us toll-free, 1-877-287-7366. Starting tomorrow in the United States, the era of don't ask, don't tell comes to an end. Gay and lesbian soldiers may serve openly in the American military. But the legacy of don't ask, don't tell and the official discrimination that preceded it will not disappear with the stroke of a pen. The Current's Gord Westmacott has produced a documentary called To Serve With Pride about three gay soldiers and their experiences in the U.S. military. Here's an excerpt.
While I was on active duty, I was totally closeted, and I was, you know, I don't know that anybody was aware that I was a homosexual. You know, I was very naive. I thought by joining the Army, I would become instantly become straight. You know, after I joined, I realized, you know, that I didn't change overnight, and I still had the same feelings, and of course, I was puzzled about that.
As a gay woman, it was very, very, very hard. As a young person, you really underestimate the negative effect that policy could and did have on my life. And it wasn't until I was into my early 30s and really looking at trying to have a relationship and a life that I realized that this was not going to work.
I was definitely in denial. I mean, I knew even through high school that there was these feelings I was having. And what I did was I thought I can live my life if I just choose to be straight. During training, when I had met other gay and lesbians my age that were perfectly happy of who they were, I started to realize I can actually accept myself for who I am. I actually had a really positive experience with people, and the only thing that was very hard to live with was that I couldn't be 100% honest with them because of the law.
We will have more about the effects of Don't Ask, Don't Tell tomorrow on The Current. Now, stay with us. Coming up, we have another game changer. Tsipora Burman was once called an enemy of the state by a British Columbia premier. A few years later, another BC premier was calling her a hero. She says her message hadn't changed. We'll hear that message in our next half hour with Tsipora Burman. I'm Anna Maria Tremonti. This is The Current.